You may not be familiar with the name, but Edward Oscar Heinrich, an investigator from California, was also known as one of America's first forensic scientists. He spearheaded the invention of many of the forensic tools police still use today, blood spatter analysis, ballistics, lie detector tests, and the use of fingerprints as courtroom evidence. His uncanny knack for finding clues and establishing evidence and deducing answers earned him the nickname The American Sherlock Holmes, which happens to be the title of Kate Winkler Dawson's new book. Kate is a documentary producer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, PBS NewsHour, and Nightline, and she teaches journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Kate Winkler Dawson joins us now to tell us more about American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Welcome, Kate.
Hi, Tammy. Thanks for having me.
American Sherlock tells the story of Edward Oscar Heinrich, but can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Sure. So he was really unusual in his time period because he was formally trained as a forensic scientist, and most people weren't. Most experts he worked in 1910 till he died in 1953. So this is more than 40 years he was in this industry. And then, during this time period, almost anyone could call themselves an expert in forensics, and there was no real way to test it because there weren't formal classes and there wasn't a certification program. He actually had professional training, which is what made him a Sherlock Holmes character. So he grew up in Tacoma, Washington, and his father died really unexpectedly and tragically, and it left Oscar with responsibility of being the sole provider for his mother and his two sisters. And so he dropped out of high school, and he became eventually a pharmacist by the time he was 18, which seems incredible, but he was brilliant, and he learned about making drugs and watching people, so sort of deduction. And also, an interesting note, he said this is where his love of handwriting analysis began, because he had to decipher the horrible handwriting of the doctors who were issuing the prescriptions. And so he talked his way into UC Berkeley, despite not having a high school diploma, and he got a degree in chemistry, and he learned about every type of science at UC Berkeley. Again, this is unusual in this time period for somebody to have that much education. So he became a sanitation engineer. He became a chemical engineer. He became a police chief. And all of these things happened before he became a forensic scientist, before he was hired as an expert witness. So he's considered the first professional expert witness, somebody who had real credentials, who could actually analyze the evidence. And what made him most unusual, I think, is because he knew so many disciplines in forensics, botany, entomology, how bugs arrive to a corpse, forensic geology, bloodstain pattern analysis, fingerprinting, all of these things. He knew them all, and he knew them very well, so he could walk into a crime scene, like maybe a normal shooting death, and not just look at the ballistics, but he could look at the entire crime scene and come up with, 10 different tests that he could run to just give police a fuller picture of what actually happened.
We talk about forensics when we're talking about this. Was that an old term, or is that more of a new term? I mean, did he call himself a forensic scientist, during
his work? He did not.
Okay.
No, he did not. So an interesting, that was, I had thought about that actually last night. So he has sort of a sidekick, a Watson-type character named John Boynton Kaiser, who was a reference librarian in Tacoma. And John Boynton Kaiser and Oscar were trying to come up with what was his title. He was a college professor. He taught, criminology and criminalistics at UC Berkeley for decades, but he didn't want to be a professor. He didn't want to call, Boynton says, Kaiser says, you're not a chemist. You're more than a chemist. And so they settled on criminalist, which I'm not sure Heinrich was completely pleased with, because quite frankly, he didn't love being in the criminal world. He liked being a star. He loved being respected. He liked solving cases. But I think it just, he really disliked criminals, and he didn't like most police officers. So you know, I think criminalist is what he settled on. But no, nobody called themselves forensic scientists. And nobody even said the word forensic then.
Heinrich is not a majorly well-known historical figure. So how did you learn about him?
So my first book was called Death in the Air, and it was about a deadly air pollution disaster in London and a serial killer stuck in it. And so I had covered science before, and I love how science can be intermingled with murder. And so I decided I wanted my next book to be forensics. So I grew up in my dad's law school classes at the University of Texas. And so this was sort of, I felt like it was in my DNA. And so I just went and bought a book on an encyclopedia on criminals, which sounds like a silly book to buy, but it was amazing for me. And I, you know, started from the Pilgrims and worked my way through, and I started, you know, wading my way through all of the gangsters in the 1920s, and I ran across this great case, which was the Siskiyou train robbery, and it was a botched train robbery in 1923 in Oregon, and Oscar worked on the case, and in the story, it referred to him as America's Sherlock Holmes. And so anybody who's interested in mysteries or true crime or criminal justice is, of course, you know, your antenna is going to go up when you see that sort of phrase. So I was very excited to dig in and find out more about him. And I found out he has a massive collection at UC Berkeley. Thank goodness. It was incredible. It had all of his case files. It had his notes, his journals, his diaries, evidence that he shouldn't have kept. They found two or three pistols and they had to that were loaded, and they had to come and remove the firing pins because it was dangerous. I mean, he had bomb parts. It was a treasure trove is an understatement.
This is What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Here's the rest of our conversation on Kate Winkler Dawson's American Sherlock. In American Sherlock, you tell us about some of the important forensic innovations Oscar Heinrich was instrumental in bringing about, but you also hint at some really significant mistakes he made. Can you give us an example of one?
So, you know, another modern term that we've been using probably in the last couple of decades is called junk science. And so these are forensic science techniques that actually involve very little science. And it's called pattern matching. So things like fingerprints, you know, you take the fingerprint off of a glass of water that a suspect, you know, used, and then you compare that fingerprint perhaps to something, you know, a murder weapon that we know is a murder weapon, and you compare the two. So comparing things like fiber, like fingerprints, like shoe prints, like bite marks, all of these things are subjective. They're really, it comes down to the opinion of the expert who is looking at them. And Heinrich really believed that handwriting analysis was definitive. If you write something on a piece of paper, I can compare it to a, you know, different document, and I can tell you whether you're the one who signed it or not. Well, now we know it's just not true, that different things can affect our handwriting. Environments, medicine maybe we're even taking. I mean, there are so many variables. It could be your age. Do you have arthritis? And so it's unreliable. Same thing with fingerprinting. And if you think about, I really realized this when I was at the DMV a couple of months ago, and I was having my license renewed, my driver's license. And, you know, they have you do the fingerprint, and you put it on the glass, and it's, you know, for the state, it has to be a very high-quality fingerprint.
Right.
It took me four times to get the fingerprint right, my thumbprint. So think about that. If that is the high standard that the state of Texas is holding for the quality of a thumbprint, how are you going to get a similar quality thumbprint or fingerprint off of a glass of water? They're going to be smeared. It's not going to be pushed in enough. You're not going to be able to see the ridges well enough. And yet we're still using this type of evidence. And it's not been, you know, something that has been discredited in courts. And Heinrich developed fingerprint evidence. And as you'll read, one of his biggest cases was Fatty Arbuckle, who was a silent film star who went on trial for manslaughter for, you know, killing a woman accidentally during a party. And the evidence that Heinrich used was absolutely bad evidence. And yet the outcome of many trials that he was involved with were in his favor because he was so convincing. And that's dangerous as an expert who is convincing in court, who's using bad science. So he developed all of these amazing tools, ballistics and chemistry and toxicology, but he also developed some junk science that I don't think they didn't realize it back then. They thought a fingerprint is a fingerprint. They thought it was really easy using trigonometry to predict how tall a suspect is using blood spatter, and that it's just not the case. Now we know that. They didn't then.
True crime and crime solving and forensics, TV shows and books and movies, they're all very popular. Case in point, you love your book on criminals that you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Why are we so fascinated with the subject?
Well, you know what's interesting? I don't know if a lot of folks know this, but women are the largest audience for true crime, which seems even more unusual. I'm a woman who writes about generally men killing women, and I love true crime. And you would think that that is counterintuitive, but it's just not. I think that women specifically, but larger audiences are fascinated. It's like that voyeurism thing. A friend of mine likens it to sci-fi. It's kind of the same thing. Why do we love sci-fi? Because it takes you into a world that hopefully, fingers crossed, none of us will be involved with. It teaches you lessons. Like, you can watch something on television, like a Dateline NBC, or you can read a true crime book, and you can see what someone did wrong. Not to blame a victim, but, what I would have not done in that situation. And it maybe in some weird way helps prepare you. My mom, who is 76, loves true crime. And I asked her one time, why do you like this so much? I love it. I know why I love it, but why do you like it so much? She thinks it's going to prepare her. I don't know for what. If she thinks the serial killer is going to be in her closet and she's going to be able to figure out how to get away based on whatever she's watching on 48-hour mysteries. But I think that is that way of thinking. And I hate to admit it, but in my part, it's a little bit more of, better than me in some ways. Like, boy, I'm glad that didn't happen to me. I'm glad I didn't marry that person, or I would have never done that trip, or, whatever it is. And so I think it's complicated, but it is a genre that just continues to grow and grow and grow.
That's Kate Winkler Dawson. Her new book is American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. And it is truly fascinating. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Kate.
Thank you, Tammy. I appreciate it.
Granny's always raving and ranting, and she's always puffing and panting, and she's always screaming and shouting, and she's always brewing up tea.
She had tried to return the book. As soon as she realized it had been left behind, she'd picked it up and rushed after its extraordinary owner. But he'd gone. He moved surprisingly swiftly for someone so old. Maybe he really didn't want to be found. It was a plain, pale green exercise book, like the one Monica had carried around with her at school, filled with details of homework assignments. Her friends had covered their books with graffiti of hearts, flowers, and the names of their latest crushes, but Monica was not a doodler. She had too much respect for good stationery. On the front cover were three words, beautifully etched in copperplate script: The Authenticity Project. In smaller writing in the bottom corner was the date, October 2018. Perhaps, thought Monica, there would be an address, or at least a name on the inside, so she could return it. Although it was physically unassuming, it had an air of significance about it. She turned over the front cover. There were only a few paragraphs on the first page. How well do you know the people who live near you? How well do they know you? Do you even know the names of your neighbours? Would you realise if they were in trouble, or hadn't left their house for days? Everyone lies about their lives. What would happen if you shared the truth instead? The one thing that defines you, that makes everything else about you fall into place. Not on the internet, but with those real people around you. perhaps nothing. Or maybe telling that story would change your life, or the life of someone you've not yet met. That's what I want to find out. There was more on the next page, and Monica was dying to read on. But it was one of the busiest times of the day in the cafe, and she knew it was crucial not to fall behind schedule. That way, madness lay. She tucked the book into the space alongside the till, with the spare menus and flyers from various suppliers. She'd read it later, when she could concentrate properly.
That's how the Authenticity Project starts. It's also the title of writer Claire Pooley's new book. Claire is an author from London. She got her start writing a popular blog on her struggles with motherhood and her alcohol addiction. The Authenticity Project is based on the seemingly simple premise of sharing the truth about our lives. Julian, an aging, lonely, eccentric artist, starts the Authenticity Project notebook, and before long, the notebook finds its way into the hands of five other strangers, who all, one by one, become part of a community this notebook has created. The Authenticity Project is cleverly crafted and perfect for anyone looking for an uplifting book with colorful characters. Here's our What We're Reading conversation with writer Claire Pooley. The Authenticity Project is the name of your book, but it's also an idea one of your characters has, Julian, who is an older gentleman, a lonely, eccentric artist. He writes in a notebook, "Everyone lies about their lives. What would happen if you shared the truth instead?" He includes his own story, admitting how lonely he's been since his wife died. He then leaves the notebook for others to find, read, and share their own truths. What a great idea. What was the inspiration behind this novel?
Well, actually, the inspiration was my own life, because 5 years ago, if you looked at my life from my Instagram feed or my Facebook feed, it all looked like it was pretty perfect. And the reality was very different, because at the time I was horribly addicted to alcohol, and it was causing huge problems in my life, so my mental health and my physical health and everything. But nobody knew that, you know, from the outside, it was all fine. And I didn't write the truth in a notebook, but what I did do was I wrote the truth in a blog. And writing that blog really changed my life. And it changed the life of thousands and thousands of people all over the world who read it and realized that there was a way out of alcohol addiction, and there was life on the other side. And that really made me think, well, if sharing the authentic truth can create these, you know, these magical waves, then what might happen if other people did it? And that was the inspiration.
I really admired how you got into the heads and minds of all your characters. For example, we just mentioned Julian, who frequently reminisces on his late wife. And then there's Monica, who is organized and focused and independent almost to a fault. And Hazard, who is himself trying to overcome addiction. Just to name a few characters, I thought you really brought these characters alive. How did you get into the heads of each of these very different types of people?
I didn't realize while I was writing it what I was doing. And it took my 16-year-old daughter to tell me what I'd done. So she read the book when I'd finished it, and she said, "Mummy, you do realize that all of these characters are, in a way, a bit of you." And actually, I think I got so used to writing as therapy that actually what I was doing was the same thing. I was exploring all, you know, my own flaws through these different characters. So Monica is a bit of a control freak, and I can be like that sometimes. And Hazard is an addict, and as I was. And there's a mummy Instagrammer who is struggling with being with a very, very small baby. And, you know, and that really reflected some of the tough times that I had, you know, having small children. So, you know, although they are all fictional and they're all very different, they all share something with me.
I think it's hard to admit when we're lonely or our deepest desires or our biggest flaws, yet each character in the Authenticity Project seems compelled to say so or to reach out to others through this notebook. What do you think drives us to admit such intimate things?
I think we very rarely do. And, I guess what I would like to feel is that when people read the book, that it makes them think next time somebody says, how are you, rather than going fine, that you might actually tell them the truth and open up about some of the things that are really going on in your life. Because, I think what we're all missing is that authenticity and that sense of community. And that's really what comes through in the book is the characters through telling their truths meet each other and create a sort of a very supportive community that changes all their lives.
A lot of the story takes place in Monica's cafe. Monica, of course, one of the characters in the Authenticity Project. You made this cafe feel like home. Would you describe it for us? And of course, tell us if there is a real Monica's cafe.
Oh, you know what? I wish there were a real Monica's cafe.
Oh,
because
darn.
Monica's cafe is my ideal cafe. And I think we all do this. You know, we sort of, you know, we imagine sort of our perfect place to hang out. And Monica's cafe is very, it feels like being in somebody's house in that all you've got little armchairs and it's all a bit mismatching. And there's a bookcase with books in, and she encourages people to take a book away with them as long as they leave another one in its place. So it's like her little library. And so the whole cafe smells of coffee and books.
Have you heard any feedback yet on your book? I'm curious to know if people are starting their own authenticity projects, and do you think this would work in real life?
Yeah, I mean, what's lovely is I've had people say that reading the book made them reach out to a friend they hadn't seen for years, or it made them think more about what they put on their Instagram feeds. Or it made them, you know, when somebody says, how are you, it made them tell them the truth and really ask their friends what's going on in their lives. So, you know, so it's been great hearing how people have you know, it's a very lighthearted book, and it's a book that sort of is, you know, just leaves you feeling uplifted, but hopefully also makes you think a bit more about what's going on in your life and the life of the people around you.
That was author Claire Pooley talking about her new book, The Authenticity Project. Audio excerpt courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio from the book The Authenticity Project by Claire Pooley, read by Anna Cordell. This is What We're Reading on KAXE KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Julia Abbott is a helicopter parent who has a tendency to overdo things. An altercation on school grounds at Liston Heights High involving Julia and a student is recorded and goes viral. Meanwhile, Isabel Johnson, an English teacher at Liston Heights, receives a threatening voicemail accusing her of teaching a blatant liberal agenda. These two incidents unite parent and teacher as a secret Facebook gossip group stirs up even more trouble for this school and small privileged suburb of Minneapolis. Minor Dramas and Other Catastrophes is an honest and engaging story of people at their best and worst. It's both humorous and heartfelt. Author Kathleen West joins me now to tell us more about her new book. Kathleen, I really enjoyed the story. It seemed to me that you may have been carrying it around with you for several years while you were busy teaching. So how did the book finally come about?
Yes, that's a great question. You know, actually, I resisted writing a book that was so close to my life. I had had an idea of becoming a novelist for a long time, but then I got caught up in, you know, the normal adult things like working and raising my children, and I hadn't really taken the time to develop a writing habit or put pen to paper. And when I first started writing a novel, I actually started on a totally different project. It was a multi-generational family saga that was really never meant to be. And when the seed of an idea came to me for minor dramas, actually when my own son auditioned for a middle school musical, and I was really anxious to know what part he got in the play, just like my main character, Julia Abbott, is about her own son, then the words just started flowing really much more quickly, and the book just kind of came out of me, which, you know, looking back on it, seems obvious that this was the story that I was meant to tell. So you asked whether I was carrying it around for years. I guess I was, but I wasn't really conscious of that.
The characters in your book, like you just mentioned, Julia being very eager about her son's chances in the play, all the characters seemed very real. For example, the teachers at Liston Heights, and particularly Isabel's colleagues. What's the percentage of fiction to real life in these characters?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I definitely used my 20 years of experience to put these characters together, but I would say that they're kind of an amalgamation of all the people that I have worked with and known in my time, taking the most extreme traits from various colleagues over the years and putting them together. I think there's the principal stands out to me as a character that was especially fun to write. I've written a kind of inept principal, well-meaning but not super great at execution. And I then felt sort of like, oh, gosh, I hope none of my bosses think that this character is based on them. I think there's a natural conflict between teachers and administration, and I kind of exploited that for this character. I definitely drew on, like, everyday experiences of a teacher, so the experience of chaperoning a dance and screening kids to make sure that they're all set to go to come inside, the experience of being at a faculty meeting, all of those things are my real-life feelings and emotions about kind of the more absurd parts of being a teacher, but none of the characters are exact replicas of people that I've known.
That won't stop people from seeing themselves in those characters, though, right?
No, I don't think that. It definitely won't. In fact, my husband asked me about one of the characters. He's like, well, how does your friend Chad feel about being gay in the novel? Chad is straight and married to a woman. And I said, oh, that's not Chad. But he saw Chad in that character. And a couple of other people have called me and said, oh, I recognize so-and-so. And, yeah, I think it's natural for people who have known me to see themselves in the work. But I was really conscious of trying to make everybody look good in the end and to really make sure that I was showing everybody's best intentions. The truth is, in my career in teaching, I found that 99% of people who enter the profession are doing it because they have these really idealistic and optimistic views about kids and the future of our society. And I hope that comes through, even in some of the more ridiculous situations.
Now, social media plays a really important role in minor dramas and other catastrophes. What has been your experience with social media in your own teaching career, and I guess how did you decide to work that in?
Yes, social media is inescapable, I think, in modern American life and in American schools. And overall, I've really enjoyed the rise of social media in my career. I've always been somebody who's an early adopter of technologies, and I had a Twitter account in 2008, which is, I think, the year that Twitter started, and I've always used it in my teaching, too. I found it a great way to amplify student work and to bring in voices in new ways. So I've been a big social media proponent. I think the dangers of social media that we all know about are that using these tools requires some thoughtfulness and reason, and those things can fail us in moments of stress, which is what happens to the characters in this book. You know, like when you're very angry and your phone is in your hand, bad things can happen. So I really tried to explore that. And I think everybody knows, but sometimes we need a reminder about how powerful our little handheld computers are and how powerful our voices can be and how our words can have lifelong consequences and last forever in the current media landscape. And as a society, I think we'll probably have to evolve because it's so common to make mistakes. So perhaps we'll become more forgiving. But until then, I think adults especially and the kids in their lives have to use extreme caution.
You're listening to Minnesota writer Kathleen West on KAXE KBXE. Her debut novel is the story of a modern high school, overworked teachers, micromanaging parents, social media, and the students caught in between. It's called Minor Dramas and Other Catastrophes. Here's the rest of our conversation with Kathleen West. You've mentioned how you were a teacher for 20 years, and I imagine that as a teacher, you've seen just about every behavior in parents, but
yes.
but you're also a parent. So how do these two things inform how you interact with your children's teachers?
Yes, I think all parents have the same inclination that Julia Abbott, my helicopter mom in my book, have. Like, I desperately want what's best for my own children. When they feel pain, I feel pain. And I definitely have the inclination to shield them from major and minor disappointments in their lives, just like Julia Abbott does and just like the parents that I've worked with do. So I do have to coach myself as a mom, using what I know about child development and psychology and everything I've learned in my teaching career about how important failure is. As a teacher, I really believe in providing safe opportunities to fail for kids. Like, what better time in your life to completely bomb at something than middle school or high school, when the consequences feel big to you, but they're actually pretty small. Like, failing a history test in sixth grade, for instance, is not really going to have a long-term impact on your life. So as a parent, I try to coach myself about that, you know, reminding myself that failure is important, rejection is important, friendship changes are normal and important, and as many times as possible, I like to let my children process those things in their lives, you know, on their own and advocate for themselves. So I tend to be pretty hands-off in terms of contacting my own kids' teachers, but I had the advantage of working in the same school where my kids went to school for 8 years, so I had really close relationships with their teachers and a level of trust with them that a lot of parents aren't lucky enough to have. So I do understand when parents feel like they need more information.
One thing that I think our listeners would like to know is, what about your story is specifically Minnesotan?
Oh, yes. You know, I am a lifelong Minnesotan, sort of by accident. I always envisioned kind of being a cosmopolitan person and moving from city to city, but just circumstance kept me in Minnesota forever. I grew up in Mendota Heights, Minnesota, which is just south of St. Paul, like a first-ring suburb there. And then I went to McAllister College in St. Paul. And then right after college, I met my husband, who is a rabid Minnesotan Vikings and Gophers fan and believes that Minnesota is the best place on earth. So we are never leaving. I agree with him that it's a great place to be. And so when I was writing this story, there's really no other place that I would write up about besides Minnesota. I think that the characters have kind of a Midwestern sensibility in terms of how they interact with each other. There's kind of that veneer of Minnesota nice, where underneath there can be a little bit of passive aggression or something, because I think Minnesotans tend not to be so comfortable expressing their feelings directly. That's definitely in there. It takes place in a Minnesota February, and I think a Minnesota February, we all know, can be really tough in terms of the steely gray sky and you know, our vitamin D stores are getting low, and perhaps our emotional reserves are low from that lack of sunlight and lack of warmth. That plays a role in the story as well. And, I mean, I think Minnesota residents might recognize Liston Heights as a stand-in for a suburb like Edina or Wayzata or Minnetonka, and have fun making parallels there as well.
What do you want readers to take away from minor dramas and other catastrophes?
Well, first of all, I hope that readers really enjoy the story. It's gratifying for me when somebody tells me that they stayed up later, they couldn't stop turning pages. So I really hope that the story entertains them and makes them laugh, and hopefully makes them laugh at themselves a little bit, too. I think that, you know, as a mom of teenagers myself, if we can't laugh at our own impulses, it's just a long 10 years to get through in our lives. On a deeper level, I hope that people think about women and their careers and their motherhood and their desire for admiration and their ambition. I think that plays out a lot in the book. And just also the way that we treat one another, the value of direct communication and empathy.
Kathleen West is a veteran middle and high school teacher. She lives in Minneapolis with her hilarious husband, two sporty sons, and a very bad golden doodle. Minor Dramas and Other Catastrophes is her debut novel. Thanks for tuning in to what we're reading on KAXE KBXE. Are you stuck in a reading rut? Or have you just read a fabulous new or old book? Share your thoughts on our What We're Reading page on Facebook, email us at comments@kaxe.org, or you can call our talkback line at 218-999-9876. You can find past reviews and interviews at kaxe.org. Just search What We're Reading. Thanks to Arnold Dahl Woolley for talking favorite books. We heard music on today's show from Lanterna, the Cinematic Orchestra, Valerie June, and the Kinks. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. What We're Reading is made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota, and by you, our members. Thanks so much for supporting our programming.